My guest today is Andrew Dompier. I've known Andrew for 7 years, first as a colleague and more recently as a friend. He is an avid motivator, and his professional accomplishments have been inspirational to me. I'll let Andrew introduce himself through his life stories that we're going to go through in this podcast. Andrew, welcome to the very first Pivot Play.
Thanks, man. Thanks, Adi. It's good to be here. I appreciate you inviting me. And like I said, being the first is always spotless and pain-free, I promise.
Yep. We've talked about it for a while, and all the honor is mine. Thank you for being here. And we're going to touch on a few topics today. I'm going to throw a few softball, a few hardball. But first, what's your obsession with dinosaurs? What's that all about?
I think it started when I was a kid. If you remember the original Power Rangers series, there was they had dinosaurs that they would call upon, right? Those were their Zords or whatever you wanted to call them, but it was amazing, right? I was a huge fan. I loved the imagination behind it, the power behind them, the fact that there's so much mystery behind these things too. So super cool. And it just kind of carried over through my adulthood.
So just childhood memories of a magical being.
They're real. They weren't magical, but to our eye, right? To our research.
So what's your favorite one?
I mean, technically it's not a dinosaur, my favorite one, but it is a family of the pterosaurs, so the flying species. So the pterodactyls, as the common name goes, those are my favorite ones. They're essentially like 6-foot flying scavengers, like vultures essentially. Mm. But so cool, man. They just have flight. They're massive. The wingspan, they can just fly anywhere they wanted to. Super powerful, right. But also very majestic at the same time.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, because recently you acquired a tooth or something. Some kind of a tooth that's worth some pretty penny.
Part of my diversification efforts in my asset catalog, yes. But yeah, it's a pretty neat area that I fancy. So it's nice to be able to have a little bit of that history in my pocket.
Okay. So explain to me how that's an investment. And first question. Second question, how do you know it's real?
So to answer the second one, it comes from a reputable source, the certificate of authenticity. It has all of that
eBay.
Information.
Yes.
Don't you buy everything off of Craigslist? but the part that I enjoy, so the fact that it's something historic and something that is 66 plus million years old, right? And something that personally means a lot to me in terms of how much I appreciate it, the level of connection that I have to something like that since I was a child. And I'm fortunate enough and grateful enough to be in a position where I can have an opportunity to diversify some of the assets that I own and some of the financial plays that I'm able to make. I'm able to do something like this and to be able to have a piece of art that's historically only museums,
right,
in my own home, to share with myself, my family, to be able to appreciate it in front of me. Instead of looking at a dollar amount in a savings account that gets no appreciation, something like this, even if it doesn't appreciate, I get to appreciate it day in and day out. So it's nice.
So that tooth is going to be your family heirloom, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah. So it's pretty cool. It's a, and for detail, it's a Nanotyrannus. So it's a juvenile T-Rex. It's about 3 inches in size in length. And still connected to the rock that it was found in. It was found over in North Dakota, part of the Hell Creek Formation.
Wow.
But I got it off of a reputable auction house. So
I didn't know Craigslist does auctions, but
yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah. But, so it's pretty neat, man. It's nice to be able to see it in its glass case and keep it in the house and enjoy it.
No, when I saw the picture, the colors were, it kind of startled me because you think about teeth from so long ago, mm-hmm. you think it's like just dry bones, you know?
Yeah, there's slight renovations and cleaning that are like hygienics that needs to go into restoring it, to making sure that it's able to be viewed the right way. The color is really pronounced, but the part that you're really trying to look for when you acquire these things is making sure that the original and state of that material, that piece, is still in its most ideal and still intact.
Is there anything you need to do to maintain it?
No, I mean, keep it out of the lights, keep it out of some natural, stuff like that. Yeah.
Keep it dry.
Yes, and don't drop it.
Don't drop it. Okay, that's very interesting.
I'm glad we started with dinosaurs. It's cool.
You are the first dinosaur aficionado that I know of. And it's always interesting because you carry it through your adult life and, you know, like your new investment is something to do with a dinosaur.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I figure there's no reason to change your interest, what your passions are, whether you're a kid or you're an adult.
Right.
There's no reason why you should change who you are.
Fair enough. So, you know, this podcast is, it's a conversational, you know, piece, but I'd like to pick people's brain, especially those that have gone through quite a bit of changes and fluctuations in their lives, you know, and how they move from one place to the next, you know, climbing one hill to the next. So let's take you back to your early years, early days. Maybe start with your college. Where did you grow up? How'd you end up in college and studying what you studied?
Okay, well, that was about Lord knows how long. I was always born and raised in Orange County, California. I went to school for communication studies because at the time I really didn't care about college. I was really just doing it just to satisfy my parents, get a piece of paper.
Right.
Because I was steadfast, 100% certain that my life was going to be set and I was going to be the next Ryan Seacrest.
All right. Okay.
I thought
I was going to hear like NBA player.
But... No, yeah, no, if I was different genetics, maybe. Okay. But I really wanted to make it in the media industry. Like I was head on to be a radio DJ. I wanted to be somewhat on the air, somewhat on some level of on-air talent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I aspired to, right? I spent about 7-8 years in media and entertainment. So I was doing everything from interning, getting coffee, to street team, setting up tents, giving away stuff at gas stations, to hosting and emceeing some events,
whatever it took
to just get experience and get out there. But
I
quickly realized, and this is a completely separate topic, obviously, but I quickly realized that industry just wasn't for me. So I'm glad, to answer your question about college, I'm glad that I was able to fulfill that degree, get my 4-year college degree from Long Beach State in communication studies. And thankfully, the skill set that I've learned through radio, what I learned through school, happened to be transferable.
And was that your first paying job in the communications field?
No. I first worked at Blockbuster Video.
Blockbuster?
I worked at Blockbuster Video.
All the millennials are wondering, what is Blockbuster?
If you watch the latest Netflix series, there was a Blockbuster comedy on there. But I did work. I worked for Blockbuster. I was like a customer service rep for a little while. Then I got promoted to be a sales manager. And a little pat on the back. And I outsold many stores on my own when we were advertising the Blockbuster Total Access membership, which was the competition to Netflix at the time.
So
Blockbuster had started their own online version, and I was the number one seller in the country.
I was once a member.
Yeah. I probably sold you on it.
No, we didn't know each other. But how did you sell? How did you sell it? Just people coming through the store and you kind of...
Yeah.
You know, interrupting their video rental browsing experience.
I wouldn't say interrupting. I would say enhancing their experience.
Okay.
But as they would come to check out their videos, I approached them about the unique opportunity to add another level to their video playing home experience, and that included online at the time.
So at that time, how many of them that you approached actually knew something about Netflix?
Great question. I'd say more than half.
Really?
Yeah. But
okay.
It's not necessarily about knowing whether you know the competition or not. Everybody knows their competition. It's about what can you offer in addition to what the competition can offer.
And at that time, they're kind of already over the peak of their success, right? Blockbuster.
Oh, by far.
By far.
We were just really just trying to scrape by, figuring out what to do to stay in the game.
But, you know, I remember in my Michigan college days, I mean, I was a Blockbuster customer. There's something magical about just browsing through videos and movies. It's like going through a library and kind of picking through what you want to watch.
Yeah, I agree. And I love the feeling of being able to walk in the store and then seeing everything kind of right there. And it's kind of like what we do now with Netflix. Like we spend most of our time looking most of our time looking through the library to figure out what we want to watch. And that's exactly what you did at Blockbuster.
That's true. That part is true. But the magical is different.
Yes, it is a little bit different.
The magical feeling is different. So Blockbuster, how did you end up working at Blockbuster? Was that just because you're interested in movies?
That was proximity. It was near the house. I could walk to work.
Okay.
I love the idea that I get free videos and free games as an employee. You did? Yeah, so I got to rent videos, rent games.
Okay.
Before they were released to the public. So that was a nice little perk. And I was 17, 16 years old. So it was a fun gig for me.
Right. So to do that these days, I think the closest would be like a GameStop or...
Yeah.
There's no equivalent for movies anymore.
No. It would be GameStop.
Right?
Yeah.
Old mom and pop stores that are still around.
Yep.
Okay. So you were at Blockbuster, and then what else did you do through your... you know, spare time and side gigs? Because I think you have quite a few side hustles.
At that time, not much. I mean, I was still going to school, right? I finished Blockbuster, went to high school in Orange County, St. John Bosco High School.
Okay.
Graduated there in 06.
Yeah, I saw you went back.
I went back 10 years later, 10 plus years later to do a career day.
Okay.
So I had the opportunity to go back and speak to some of the kids.
Right.
Which I was a part of at one point.
Right.
So it was a really great experience to go back there and talk to the kid and talk to them about my career, my experience, my role. And at the time I was at Google. So I was able to talk to them about how to get into tech and some of the things to expect in life, some of the things they maybe need to prepare themselves for a bit. And then it was a really great opportunity to get back. And I had a ton of kids coming up and asking questions. So it's always good to pay it forward a little bit.
There's not enough of those type of opportunities and events and sessions, especially for high schoolers.
Yeah. And especially with careers, I think maybe they gravitate toward, right? Companies that they know, are familiar with, and they just want to hear from a real person and not some bot giving them fake advice. Like it's nice to be able to talk to a human-to-human connection. So actually that day had a lot of really great speakers, like not just myself, but I heard a Clippers individual. We had people from local hospitals. We had people doing carpentry, labor, like the really, really specialized skill sets that were there. So it was really cool to be able to speak amongst really talented people, but then offer something unique in each avenue.
That's cool.
Yeah.
By the way, I forgot whether your camera is running. Did we hit play on them? Hit record?
I don't know. I thought you did.
Can you see it from your watch?
No, it wasn't connecting.
Okay. Let me just check real quick.
All right. I thought you hit it. Well, I can see it in the reflection, but it's not recording at all.
It's not recording.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a good thing you thought of it now.
Okay.
So the other ones are started?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
The other ones are started. Yep.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
You want to start over?
No.
Okay.
Let's continue.
Okay.
So you did communications. I mean, did you hate it? Did you like it? Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed the interpersonal side of what the courses offered. I enjoyed the storytelling aspect of communication studies, but I just generally didn't enjoy school that much. Like I was good enough to get by. Like I graduated 3.5 plus GPA, all through my high school, I was 3.6, 3.7 GPA plus.
Right.
So it was never, I was never
active. That's higher than me, by the way. So congratulations.
Yeah. My courses might've been easier. I didn't necessarily struggle academically, but it just wasn't, and maybe that's why it wasn't super exciting to me. And kids go to school, but like, if that's a path for you, definitely go to school.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really my calling. And I knew that I just needed to get the paper and continue what I wanted to do. And at the time it was radio. So hindsight is 2020, right? Because if I look back and I didn't get the degree, I would have not been as fortunate maybe as I am today. So I'm glad that I did follow through and get the degree.
And okay, so you got the degree. Did you end up in radio at some point?
Yeah, I did. I was really lucky. A lot of the advice I got from my peers and my mentors at the time told me if I want to get into the LA market or the New York market, which are the big markets,
right?
You need to go make your mistakes somewhere else.
So they don't see it.
Yeah, exactly. So you get your mistakes done. You do it in a smaller market. You get better. You hone your craft, and then you come back to the LA market when you're ready.
Okay.
And you kind of blossom from there. So I did that. I went over to Palm Springs.
Okay.
I was in Palm Springs for about 2 years. I had my own night show. I did a morning show.
Local radio.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. At the time, it was called Desert Radio Group.
Okay.
And I was a night jockey for 93.7 KCLB, which is a rock station, which I knew nothing about rock.
Wow.
And then I did a hot AC, hot adult contemporary morning show called Crush 103.9. And that one was like the Madonnas, the John Mayers, the Jason Mraz music. So that was really cool. So I had a lot of experience. I got paid diddly squat for about 2 years.
Two years, right.
But I figured, you know what? It's worth the sacrifice because one day I'm going to be on big time radio, big time air. I'm going to make big money and it'll be fine. And plus the passion is going to override how much money I was not making.
Yeah.
That money never came. I hung up my headphones. And then I fell into aerospace.
But those 2 years were, that was your full-time gig.
That was my full-time job. Yeah. Yeah. I did that. I was also a music producer for one of the shows or music coordinator for one of the shows. I actually programmed the music.
Okay.
So I got some of my programming experience from then. And then I did go back to LA, but I didn't go back to LA technically on the air. I was a producer for one of the, for the Rick D's morning show on Hot 92.3. I was usually producing shows, so I'd be on the air, but it wasn't my show.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
So, all right. No regrets. It was a really great experience. I loved it.
Well, why did you think you hung up your headphones then and not just continue on?
It kind of comes down to, I think the big question that everybody kind of faces when they strive to find success in a passion project or passion career, right? It's whether you're in the arts or whether you're in some level of like something that you just truly love and don't make money on, you get to a point in your life where you're like, okay, how far do I keep pushing?
How long are you going to be the starving artist?
Right. Like how long do you keep going? Right. Do you ask yourself, okay, do I hang it up now? Or is my turning of the tide right around the corner? And I asked myself that question many times over the 7-8 years that I spent in it. I did a little bit of a half in, half out type of deal when I came back to Orange County, took an aerospace job during the day. I was still doing my, I was tracking my morning show from Orange County and sending it over to Palm Springs for a little while. So I can still do a bit of both.
Right.
While I tried to find an LA gig.
Okay.
But that LA gig never came and I just ended up staying in aerospace.
Mm. And that was, and how long were you in aerospace for?
Total
at that time.
At that time,
I guess at that time.
Yeah, I ended up being in aerospace for about 7 years. So for a temporary gig that was paying me $14 an hour,
right?
Covering somebody on maternity leave that was only intended to be about 6 months, that turned into a seven year journey, which I had obviously different roles as I iterated across. But
Wait, so that 7 year job started when you were substituting for somebody who was on maternity leave.
Yeah, that's correct. That's how I got into aerospace.
Okay, what was the role and what was the company and what did they do?
The company was Zodiac Aerospace.
Okay.
We produced interior monuments, interior products for regional aircrafts. I worked for a program or a company, a manufacturing house called Embraer.
Right.
I was an engineering admin, so I just did administrative work, updating parts lists, doing stuff for the engineers. Really, really basic entry level stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, I was just supposed to cover somebody on maternity leave. And then
they liked you.
She came back. Yes. They wanted to keep me, so I stayed on. I also was starting to get a feel for the routine of having a day-to-day job.
Right.
I was still doing my tracking of the radio show, so I was still getting that on the side. But then I started getting a hang of that, started seeing what other roles they had in aerospace. I wanted to chase a little bit more. Started seeing another guy there named Chris, who was the customer engineer, and he basically met all these new customers. He would go to the customers, meet them, go over a catalog of what they wanted,
right?
Come back and build that contract, and then we would essentially operate to it or work toward it. And so I loved that role. So I was like, okay, maybe I should try that. So I started learning, started teaching myself how to read LOPAs, how to design LOPAs, how to do general arrangements. So I trained myself on how to do that with some of the engineering support.
Okay. You said LOPAs. What are those?
Layouts of plane arrangement.
Okay.
But thanks for calling me out.
It's kind of like the map of what an airplane, commercial airplane,
exactly,
seating look like with all the arrangements of the equipment and all that stuff.
Right. It's the blueprint of what's going to be in the plane. Yeah. Yeah. So I worked with engineering to try and learn how to do that. So I started designing my own notebooks, designing the general arrangements and some of the details so I could copy what the customer engineer was doing. And it just so happened that not long after that, he ended up leaving the company. So there was an opening.
Okay.
So I took that role on, unofficially, I suppose. So I started doing it. That was great. I got a lot of experience in that. Did that for a little while. Started seeing more of the world of what that program offered. Realized that maybe I wanted to get in program management because at the time, the PM, what she was doing at the time seemed like something that I could be good at, something I was interested in.
Yeah.
And it just so happened when I started kind of focusing on that role, she decided to transition to another PM role. So there was going to be another opening.
Wow.
So I was fortunate again that once I kind of set my sights on something, that role became open and I interviewed for it and I got that role and did that PM job for about 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Director was in and out, so I was able to play director for a little while.
Okay.
And then I realized that all I was learning how to do, all the program management that I was learning was very kind of ad hoc. I didn't have any real structure or lessons to learn how to do it maybe theoretically correct. So
a lot of learning on the job, learning
all of it, learning on the job. Yeah. I started trying to like do trainings, trying to do courses, but you know, nobody was like hands-on teaching me how to do program management correctly. So I decided what's the better way to learn how to do everything officially correct, than to be an auditor. So, okay. So it just so happened that an internal audit role opened up.
Okay.
And, I went for it. Two people were selected out of the entire company. And I transitioned into become an internal auditor, and I became an internal auditor for the umbrella company that we were acquired by.
Mm.
And so I became an auditor for literally just 3 months. 3 months, and then the acquisition official went through, and there was an entirely new department created called internal control.
Okay.
And that new company asked me and the other lady that joined to head up the entire business unit for internal control to essentially create, launch, deploy, and facilitate the annual internal control campaign. So I immediately was pulled out of internal audit after 3 months, only 2 missions.
Wow.
And immediately head of entire cabin industry, which was another business unit. So I had 30 global sites in charge, to be in charge of, and I had to initiate everything from scratch.
Did you meet these 30... like teams from 30 different sites?
Yeah, I did.
Spread across the globe?
Yeah, so we worked with an overarching program manager, the project managers who was in charge of that.
Right.
We created essentially networks at every single industry or every single site and built that team out. And that was part of that whole program establishment, that foundation. So it was really cool. I got the fortunate luxury of being able to travel to many of my sites, if not all. So I had lots of travel miles under my belt.
What were some of your memorable ones?
I mean, every single one had an awesome correspondent that I got to learn from and work with. But fortunately, I was able to travel to Asia. I was in Thailand quite often. I was in Brazil. Mm-hmm. I was in Tunisia. I was all over Europe. I mean, my travel days were insane. I was gone maybe 75% of the year. And I was doing Europe trips like weekly. Every day hitting another country. I remember there's one trip I flew out one afternoon. I get in that morning. I went straight to, I think it was Amsterdam, to go to our facility in Alkmaar. Spent half a day, got on the plane that afternoon, flew out to check, got to check, did the same thing, checked in that night, boom, yeah. hit the site, stayed the night there, left in the afternoon, went over to Germany, hit that site, did the same thing, left, went to Paris, hit that site and flew home. So it was almost like 4 or 5 countries in just the same amount of days. So,
I mean, I can imagine you already have sort of a rhythm and kind of start building a routine out of, you know, going into the site.
Yeah, I did.
Doing whatever internal control.
Yeah, I did. I got used to it. I did it for almost 3 years. So it was good. It was a blessing that I was able to fully take advantage of. So it was nice.
Sure. Sure. Okay. So if I understand you correctly, you started aerospace in kind of your early 20s through your late 20s.
Yep.
And then what happened?
After I finished internal control, I was looking, they really only want you in that role 3 years max, and then you want to take that experience and kind of go elsewhere into hopefully the same company,
right?
But at least you know how to do things, and you can start teaching some of the individual unit or sites. For me, I happen to receive an opportunity to enter the food and beverage industry, doing similar work in terms of compliance, internal control, program management. So I took my skill sets over to Lagunitas Brewing Company, which is also owned by Heineken.
Okay. So they're a full subsidiary of Heineken.
They were by the time I joined, yeah.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. And so I was supposed to move up to Northern California. Over in Petaluma, but COVID happened, and they said, okay, as soon as COVID is over at the end of the winter, you can move up. And I said, no problem. So I just worked from home, and then the new year came around and COVID was still around. So yeah. I didn't move. And then about a year and a half, I just worked from home in Orange County, traveling back and forth to Petaluma about once a month to meet with my team. But yeah, I started out as just a processing and control improvement manager. So I was in charge of Heineken controls. I was in charge of creating procedures, policies, little programs for Lagunitas.
Mm.
And then...
So you were leaning on your internal control experience at aerospace.
Yes.
In this new role.
Correct, yeah. And it just so happened that 3 or 4 months after I started, my director left the company.
Wow.
So there was immediate opening, and there was myself and a colleague that were both the same level, senior PMs.
Okay.
And I was... thankfully chosen for the role.
Did both of you went for it, or
she did not go for the role. We discussed it. But she also felt that I was in the right position, the right timing to transition to that next role.
Okay.
And that just wasn't her aspiration. So I was really lucky to become a director very, very early on.
You said 3 months after you joined
Lagunitas. After I joined Lagunitas. Yeah. So just literally within 3 or 4 months, I was already the new director.
So if I can pick on that,
mm-hmm.
what do you think was the biggest factor in enabling you to get that quick promotion? Because oftentimes you join a company, it's kind of like starting from zero, mm-hmm. right? You build your credibility, you build your reputation, people see you, and they trust you. And 3 months, I think, is quite a short time for people to see all that and trust you with a bigger responsibility. So what do you think what are some of the attributes that led you to that success?
I think I just had, I was just really lucky, right? I was really lucky that it just so happened that my director
kinda took another right place at the right time.
I was. And a quote that I go back to often is, hard work generally breeds more luck.
Mm.
And I've always been a big advocate of that. So I think taking that risk to go into a new industry, putting myself in a new position, in a new role, put me in an opportunity to have that next step to become a director. And
right.
I think my approach to some of the work was different for the Lagunitas community, right? I'm coming from a very traditional way of working in an aerospace. Lagunitas, if you don't know, is very startup, very napkins, like policies on napkins. It's a mm-hmm. beer company, right? Like we love
drink beer all the time.
We love being kind of chaotic and unique and ambiguous.
Mm.
And it was great. Like it was awesome. But it's a very different style. And I think the direction that the company was moving toward, which is more of a Heineken bread type of industry or type of company, it needed a little bit more of a structure behind it. So my experience coming from having that structure, I think, put me in a better position to take the next step or take the team to the next step. And I was lucky to have a really great team. So my colleague, who's a senior PM, was really great at what she did. She was able to be very supportive and be my ears to kind of how to manage the team. I was able to hire my replacement, who was much better at the role than I was. So it was really a great find. And then I was able to hire one other PM after that. So I was able to build out a team of 3 PMs. And yeah, I think the colleagues I worked with, all brilliant people, all really, really smart, very, very passionate. So that really helps kind of put everybody on the next step and kind of pushes everybody forward.
But things didn't turn out as you thought it would. You didn't end up relocating to NorCal?
Never did. Correctly? Never did. Stayed in Orange County.
Right.
That ended up being a little bit of a touchy point. Maybe a year and a half later, when you know, I was dealing often daily with like the management team or C-suite.
Yeah.
And there was a movement or at least an initiative to have more folks in person, which of course I'm all for, right? You can't deny the impact of having people together. So I was aware of that. I was trying to advocate that I could do the work and continue to do the successful work from home. My team is still on site pretty much every day, but it wasn't the direction the company was going. So I started having a little bit of an ear on the outside of where I would go next. And I was fortunate again that Google happened to reach out second time. And this second time is when I was able to take on that opportunity.
So before we get into the details about your time at Google, was that an opportunity that you sought out? Was that a company that you sought for your next your next leap in your career, or
Google has always been kind of a pedestal company for me, and I love the inclusivity and the diversity of what Google offers and the connection and the approach in which it tries to go for when it connects to its users or consumers. And honestly, at that time, and even in 2020, when I was at Zodiac Safran,
right,
they approached me the first time in 2020, Google did. Okay. And I didn't get that job. I went through about 6 or 7 interviews, and I knew which interview I failed, and I didn't get that job, and I was devastated. But
you knew because?
I bombed the question.
I see.
Completely bombed the question.
Okay.
And it wasn't the right role for me, as hindsight is 2020. But I never thought I didn't think at that point that I was good enough for Google yet.
Mm.
And I didn't even think I was ever going to be good enough, to be quite honest. Mm. Lagunitas called, and I took that gig at Lagunitas, and that role validated more of what I believe I could have brought to the table and helped me kind of hone my craft and really learn how to deal with people,
right?
Work in an ambiguous environment, work in a creative environment, a startup culture, which is very different from aerospace. And when the second time they called, I was much more prepared. I was much more confident. And the role they presented me was a much better fit.
So they reached out to you?
They reached out to me both times.
Both times. Yeah. Okay. I know you love quotes, Andrew. And let's see if you know what quote this is.
Okay. It's Kobe.
Over the years, I've seen many photos of Nooglers posing pictures of their Google hats. And every single time I told myself, one day, that'll be me. Today's that day. This is my Google hashtag hat. So this was you when this you first like joined the company, right?
Yeah.
And how did it feel to finally join one of your dream companies?
Honestly, it it probably shouldn't have been this much of it as it was, but it was a significant amount of validation.
Mm.
And after seeing my therapist for like a year and a half now, it's like you don't want to get validated by things like that. But at that time, it was almost like a checking the box of like, okay, you are good enough. You did make it. You reached this pinnacle of your life where like, this is the company that less than 1% of applicants get into.
Yeah.
And you made it. So again, I've always been pretty appreciative and grateful for what's come. But that getting the hat, which was just a symbol of the accomplishment and maybe the struggle that I had to go through to get to where I was. And to know no mirage of anything, like that struggle is not struggle for many people, right? Like that's not really any real struggle. But to my career struggle that I had to face to get to that level, I felt very accomplished. I felt like I made it in my career. And at that point, Google really had been like the top tier to me. Like once I got to Google, I thought I was done.
So I think in this day and age, I mean, you're right about Google's products and just the reach, the global reach that their products, I mean, there's so many of them that has touched people's lives, and that kind of drives people to want to make it to Google. You know, reminds me of something. Back in my college days, one of my jobs was as a library student supervisor. in the business school library. So University of Michigan has one of the most prestigious and ruthless cutthroat bachelor's in business administration program. And when those students, those BBA students interview, they go to the library and they look up this publication called wetfeet.com. So wetfeet is basically your guide to McKinsey or your guide to Morgan Stanley or whatever it is that you're trying to get into, right? Did you go through a similar experience where you had to research how people that make it to Google make it to Google so that maybe you can follow their footsteps? Or was that one of your chess moves, or what did you do?
For the interview process, no. I didn't really, the only thing I tried to do was really just know how to formulate and how to articulate what I've done and communicate it in a way that shows my value and what I can bring and the impact that I can make to the people that I'm working with or whoever the end customer would be. I didn't try to game to get into Google. I figured at some, like, Google contacted me, I'm obviously being considered. Okay. Now I just need to be able to showcase my abilities.
Yep. Yep.
And Google's interview process is a little unique. There's, like, just like everyone, it starts with an HR recruiter, right? But once you pass that, it goes into, and at least in my time, there was a hiring manager. Then you had four dedicated interviews for different categories.
Okay.
So once you hit all four of those, then you reconnect with the hiring manager or skip manager, whoever it may be, and that closes it out. So really, I just try to focus on one interview at a time, focus on one, that one category at a time, utilize my HR recruiter to prepare me as much as I could. But I utilized whatever outsource I could, which was my recruiter. I try to watch interviewing training videos on how to maybe formulate questions better. The one big advice I did pick up during that time was, it's okay to repeat the question.
Right.
And ask the recruiter, say, hey, do you mind if I take a moment to gather my thoughts on this before I respond? And that was something I took to heart. And I did that in the entirety of my second round.
You knew that was okay because of just some of the training videos that you watch or talking to people?
I forget where I picked it up. I think I picked it up from a recruiter, from one of the Google recruiters. And I think they had mentioned saying it's okay to totally do this. And And so I took it, I took as long as I needed. I said, okay, here's the question. Okay, great. Thanks for the question. I'm writing it down. Do you mind giving me a second to gather my thoughts on this?
So you were kind of lucky, blessed, that the recruiters reached out to you, kind of give you these tips as well and kind of help you along the way.
Recruiters always, right? They're going through so many applicants, right? And I'm sure it's tough to make a connection with every single one. But they won't reach out to you and give you more than what you need unless you ask. So I wouldn't necessarily say that they were automatically forthcoming with information like this.
They were not volunteering them.
I think you, as an applicant or as someone that wants something, you need to be able to pull.
Right.
And I have no problem pulling.
I mean, that's a great skill set to have.
I'm not afraid to pull. Let's just put it that way.
Convince people to, give you some interesting tidbits. You went through the 6-7 interviews. I mean, there were four, you mentioned there were four interviews with sort of different facets.
There are four different categories.
Yeah,
I forget the naming of each of them, but one of them was ambiguity. One of them was kind of like your cognitive. Okay. Another one was googliness.
Okay.
And I forget, maybe the analytical was the last one.
Right. And who are these people that you met in these four interviews?
They were all different Google employees, different Google people from the company.
So did you end up working with them?
None of them. They're unique, neutral individuals that I think volunteer maybe for to interview candidates.
Basically, no say whatsoever in terms of benefiting or not benefiting from your employment there.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. They're neutral. Yeah. And the only thing that they do is they ask the questions, they note the information, they ultimately rank what level that you, they believe you should be at,
right,
based on the responses,
okay,
and based on certain criteria that I think Google already has a kind of a rubric for. And yeah, they pass your info through and go from there.
Okay. And was this at the time, around the time that you wrote your first book?
nice segue.
I told you I was going to give you some gotchas.
I wrote my first book, I think when I was still at Lagunitas. I forget what year it was exactly.
You just turned 30, probably.
Yeah, because the book was called 30 Years, 30 Lessons.
Right.
And I kind of hate calling it a book because it's not really the length of a book. It's really just an ebook. Mm. I had started writing down 30 lessons that I started to appreciate and really take to heart over the 30 years of my existence at the time. And I kind of formulated, organized it because I'm very organized. I organized it in a certain way, and it just so happened to be kind of in a book format. And I thought, why don't I just release it and publish it? And if somebody else wants to have a copy, they can have a copy.
Mm.
And it was a cool experience, right? I wanted to be able to put something out there that somebody else can maybe take some value in. If maybe 1 second of that they felt better about their lives or their day, then it was worth it. So I did.
I like your first chapter. It says, it's all about that ass.
Set.
Oh, asset. Are you sure it wasn't a typo there? I mean, there's parentheses. So I'm sure it meant something.
It's all about that asset. Yeah.
It's all about that asset. So let's segue, you know, from your Google experience into this book. You said that, I'm not just talking about owning real estate or having cash, but investing in yourself also. Learn something new every single day. Talk to people, gain experience, develop relationships. Create assets, not liabilities. What do I mean by that? Invest more in things, people, ideas that bring you positive returns, assets, instead of no return or negative returns, liabilities. So how important was that lesson to you, and what did you do with that lesson?
First of all, it's really interesting to hear you reading me my book back.
It didn't sound like you.
You sound much cooler. It was that lesson for me, really. Obviously, there's the whole asset part and diversification and making sure you build yourself and your overall foundation of who you are. But it was more about understanding what doesn't belong in your life. Understanding what needs to be cut and what is going to be a distraction from your own personal growth, your mental growth, your social growth, your cultural growth, your relationship growth, whatever it may be.
Right.
I had really learned the asset versus liability from Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki, I think his last name was.
Yep.
And he talks about that, assets and liability. So that's really where I gathered it from. Literally, right? There's assets and there's liabilities. But when it comes to your own growth, I try to see it that way as well, right? There's things that you can take on that will help you become better, that will have an opportunity for you to move forward in a certain direction of your life. And there's some things that maybe won't. And those things change over the course of your life. So it's just good about, you just need to be good about reassessing what those assets and liabilities are as you progress. But understanding what those are and being aware of what your catalog of assets are.
Can you give an example? So the assets is interesting, but you talk about liabilities. Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of what are some liabilities that you've pruned away from your life along the way?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's liabilities are going to be different, right? For me, liabilities were, in this particular case, social media became a liability.
Mm.
I'm still on LinkedIn, which is I use for my career, networking, my communication aspects to my colleagues, and for obvious promotions. But social media, that was going to be distracting and would be a deterrent from what my priorities should be. So cutting that out. So I don't have Instagram. I don't have Facebook. I don't have stuff like that. That TikTok, all that, things like that. I don't use any of those. So for me, became a liability and took me away from other avenues that I could be focusing my time on.
So you actually got rid of some of that stuff because I think you used to have Instagram.
Oh yeah. I used to be active on it big time,
which made you realize it wasn't good for you.
It It was, again, like,
it wasn't useful. It wasn't fruitful. It was,
for me, it became more of a distraction and, right. and opened more of doors I wouldn't be gaining from and wouldn't be beneficial or positive for what I was aspiring in life.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. All right. Let's get back to Google. So, you know, Google obviously is a very well-known brand and company, in big tech. You know, you have the FANGs, and companies like Amazon have a certain culture, certain rituals, right? Like preparing a 6-page memo before each meeting and starting the meeting by reading the memo together in silence. Are there such habits or sacred rituals at Google? And what's your perspective on that?
I don't know if they're sacred rituals, but Google really does try to advocate for having periods of your week that are no meetings. Mm. That way you can really focus on the work in front of you.
Right.
Or take a moment to get some reprieve. Because a lot of the work that we do, and especially the work that I was doing in trust and safety, dealt a lot with private information, really, really detailed information, really harmful information, some really detrimental info. So being able to take a break from those moments was really important, especially for the work that we were doing.
I see. Okay. And
just FYI, the guy. Okay.
two minute warning. Okay. Yeah. that's interesting. So what's next for you? I mean, you have. I think you have another book coming up.
Yeah. It's kind of cool to be able to advertise, I guess, promote it here, mention it here.
Yeah,
I hadn't really talked about it just yet, but it's something that I'm really excited about. I'm looking forward to releasing it in the first quarter of 2024.
Nice.
So sometime in February, March, I'm hoping to get it done. The second draft is already complete. So I just need to finish up some of the tidying up.
Okay. What's it about?
It's going to be called Crossover Success. It is a crossover of characteristics between program management and basketball. So
nice. Two passions in your life.
Major passions in my life that I'm a huge fan of for both. I obviously have a lot of experience in program management. I love basketball. So I was able to find some commonality between the two worlds that appear to be completely different,
right.
Cross them over, show some similarities between the two, talk about some of the new methodologies that I wanted to create for it. And kind of just bleed my interests and passions on paper and hope to share it with everyone.
That's awesome, man.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks a lot for coming out and having this conversation. I look forward to having you again. And best of luck to the book release.
Thanks, Adi.
I'll be one of the first to buy your book on Amazon or wherever you're selling it.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks.
And best of luck to that. And hope to talk to you again in one of the next episodes to see how you're doing.
Thanks, Adi. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on Pivot Play. It's exciting to be here. Thanks, man.
Sounds good. All the honor is mine. And till next time.
Thanks.